I think that there's an awareness that all these hands are making things that I wear, and it becomes so special that I'm not just buying a garment because I like it, but I know that someone who made it put their hands in it, and maybe if it's a sheep that I like or an animal or a plant, that I have that connection to that.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now. The farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're having a good day.
Yes, welcome to the Good Dirt Podcast if you are new here, and you're a longtime listener, welcome back. We appreciate you so much. And either way, whether or not you're new or have been around, we have a favor to ask you. In order to make our show the best it can possibly be for you, we want to be providing the content that you most want, and that's most going to keep you around. We need you to fill out a survey for us. We know that surveys maybe are not the most fun thing to do, but we made ours really fun and exciting. So you'll see when you get there. And also, we appreciate it so much because it really, like, you guys are what makes this show happen. And we want to keep bringing you the good dirt for as long as we can. So we are giving everyone who completes the Lady Farmer survey 15% off an Almanac membership. It's our online community platform that's just for Lady Farmers, just for Good Dirt listeners. And basically just like a whole universe of good dirt goodness. The people that are part of the Almanac are amazing. I've met some incredible people through there. And we have wonderful gatherings. We've got a book club. We do events. And we prioritize our Almanac members with all kinds of member benefits, like discounts with all of our favorite partners and brands that we admire for their sustainability efforts. So the Almanac is definitely a place you want to be. And again, everyone who completes this survey will get 15% off their membership. But that's not all. You'll also be entered in to a drawing for a free ticket, so $0, a free ticket to our online virtual slow living retreat. That's happening again this year. We've got three amazing presenters for that weekend. We've got Christy Johnson, all past podcast guests, actually. Christy Johnson, Kirsten Shockey, and Eva Cosmos Flores, and we've got tons of other fun surprises and activities planned for the virtual retreat. So that being said, you definitely want to fill out the survey. You do not want to miss out. So you will go to www.ladyfarmer.com/survey, and that's where you will find the Lady Farmer survey, and we appreciate it greatly. Thank you so much.
So as we get into today's episode, I am looking down at what I'm wearing, and I'm thinking about the fiber content, and I'm thinking about where it came from, and I usually like to stick to things like natural fibers. I make an effort to do that. Cotton, wool, certainly linen in the summer, especially. I like to avoid synthetics, but sometimes they're unavoidable.
So, like, what are you noticing about what you're wearing right now?
So, I have an old oversized tank top that the content information has long ago rubbed off, but I think it's 100% cotton. It's probably not organic cotton. And I'm wearing organic cotton leggings, but they have some spandex in them because they're a little bit stretchy.
Yeah, anything that you're wearing that's stretchy is going to have spandex in it. And most likely that also includes your underwear and stuff. So if you're even thinking, if you're thinking about like everything you're wearing. So like I'm wearing packed underwear. We love packed, but it is, so it's organic cotton, but it definitely has spandex in it. I'm wearing a thrift store overalls. So yeah, again, the content tag is long gone, but I'm sure it's just denim.
But it was thrift stores.
So. Yeah, so reused. Anyways, that's what I'm wearing. So I wonder, if you're listening and you're in a position to kind of think about like what you're wearing, what's in it, who made it, it's always a good exercise to like connect with your belongings, where they came from.
Things you use every day.
Yeah.
Again, it doesn't really matter right now if you have the answer or not. And this is not a test. It's just an illustration of how, as a consumer culture, we've come to the point where the sources and the content of our most basic daily needs are largely invisible to us. It's not something we are conditioned to thinking about a lot.
Yeah. And it's kind of an issue in a few different ways, many of which we talk about here on The Good Dirt. But for today's episode, we are going to focus on one aspect of this really bit broad problem of being generally disconnected from what we wear and what we use every day.
Yeah. So back to the questions, what are you wearing and what do you know about where it was produced? And most of us really don't know a whole lot about that. But overwhelmingly, the answer probably is it was not produced in the United States. Apparel manufacturing, which was once a major player in the U.S. economy, began shifting to foreign shores from the 1960s, when we produced approximately 95% of our own clothing here in this country, until today, when the number is only around 5%.
So maybe that's a surprise to many of you, maybe not. It was definitely a surprise to us, even after we had decided to start Lady Farmer and our own apparel line made from natural fabrics sewn in the U.S. If you're a regular listener, you've probably heard the embarrassing story of how we went to this huge trade show out in Las Vegas looking for all of the domestically grown organic linen that we were going to use to sew our first clothing line. And if you haven't heard that story yet, you'll hear it in this episode.
Yeah, that was 5 years ago. And at least we can laugh about it now. And we can celebrate that there are people out there now who are putting their heart and soul into bringing textile manufacturing back home.
And that brings us to today's episode with our guests, Sandy Fisher and Durrell Van Alsten of Chico Flax, which is a textile company based in Northern California. They are pioneering or re-pioneering regenerative production and processing systems for flax in our country. You know, flax used to be grown here, and then it just sort of went away for a long time. And so they're bringing it back.
Sandy is a textile artist who's been weaving for 35 years. In 2012, she began the pursuit of a locally sourced fiber that would become Chico cloth. Durrell taught with the Butte County Office of Education before he launched his encore career with Chico Flax.
They are true trailblazers, and we were so honored to talk to them and to bring the story of their work to all of you. So now we'll turn it over to Sandy and Durrell and let them tell you the ongoing story of Chico Flax. Sandy and Durrell, welcome to the show. Would you mind telling us a bit about who you are and your background and how you got to where you are today?
Well, shall I start?
Yes, please okay. Do.
I'm a professional weaver. I've been weaving for, I hate to say it now because it's going to date me, but over 40 years, and always used natural fibers. And it wasn't till about 2012 that I was in my studio, the phone rings, and the Bangladesh fires had happened, and you know, thousands of people were killed. And a local activist in my town said, "I am not going to buy my clothes unless it's all local. What are weavers doing?" And I said, "Well," I just kind of thought, I looked at my yarns on the wall and I said, "I could weave you whatever, and we can go local, and we have a lot of wool, you know, that's available." And she goes, "Well, let's get together." And, you know, I'm kind of thinking that I'm saying that year 2012 because a lot of things were going on. You know, you have Rebecca Burgess with Fibershed happening, and then another woman who wrote Raw Material, Stephanie Welks, on wanting to knit with local fiber. So it's kind of an interesting energy that was going on. And I know it was happening elsewhere, but also I'm just thinking because I'm here in Northern California. I thought about this often, and I find that fascinating. But anyway, women, we got together and we had lunch at a lovely garden. And there was flax growing in the yard. And because it's summer, we are having extreme heat right now, but it's not uncommon to have days of 100 or plus. And it was one of those days. And, you know, wool was not appealing. So we thought, oh, let's grow flax. And, you know, here I've been weaving with flax. That's something I've always used. And I always wove with cottons. And it actually helped me redirect the way I weave. I never really thought of where my yarns came from. And I'm embarrassed to say that. But back when I started, it was just the material, the textures and the colors.
Yeah.
And here it was, you know, right in front of me, this door opening up. And that's all I weave now. I don't weave anything. I mean, I've got these yarns on my shelf. I'm going to use them because I have them. But when I go to get my yarn, I'm always getting my local area or what I'm growing. So that's transformed me, which I find really exciting. So anyway, we were talking about this flax back in 2012. And so it ended up, let's meet at the center where she was active, very involved, called the Chico Peace and Justice Center. And so we actually got a room there every Thursday, once a month, and we would meet, and we had like 40 people in this vision of what can we do? Oh, Sandy, you're a weaver. Let's do like Chico cloth. Let's make a cloth that represents us. And I was quite excited because my weaving background, I learned to weave in Northern Scotland. So they have the district checks or like county checks. And so I thought, why don't we do something with that? So we got talking and talking, and we had all these ideas. And then the months go on and nothing's happening. And I'm going like, we've got to see if it can grow here. So we got some seeds, fiber flax seeds, not flax for food flax. That was specifically for that. And we took a little plot and 10 by 10 plot, and we grew it. And we went with the traditional way of growing flax, which is 100-day lifespan. But in Europe, if you plant it in April, you're going to get 100 days. You're going to be able to harvest in June. But that's like almost 100 degrees here. So we had a real problem. You know, fiber was very straw-like. And I'm going to put Daryl in here because he came up with a great idea. So how we've advanced to where we are today.
Okay.
So
what we did the second year when so many people dropped out, because they found that it was a lot of work that was part of it. And you had, besides that, we had zeroed in on real fiber flax. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people using and admit that they're using a food flax, which is okay because you can get fiber from it, but it's not high quality. So we talked with some farmer friends of ours at a party in October one year, and somebody said, well, it's an annual, just plant it like we do winter wheat. So we've been making it a winter crop ever since.
So Joe, maybe a little bit about your background.
My background.
You kind of got involved on a small scale doing our garden. Okay.
I was a public school teacher for 35 years, and my encore career is now a regenerative agricultural flax farmer.
Oh, wow.
I will not say that again. So my background, as a kid, we moved all the time, and we lived in agricultural communities because my father and grandfather were in the farm machinery business. So I've been around it. And so it's almost a natural thing to get into. And I'm enjoying it. We are collaborating with the Center for Regenerative Agriculture at Cal State University, Chico. It's a really good program. They're getting a lot of attention. They do a lot of regenerative agriculture at their farm, in addition to traditional farming. I think it's a 700-acre farm, okay, something in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So they've got some really big orchards because we're in a heavy orchard area, and a lot of row crops and cover crops and this sort of thing. We bought in completely to the regenerative idea, and it's been working quite nicely for us. Yeah. This last spring, it was the first time we could add the animal component.
Yes.
So we hired 400 goats to come in and very casually eat all of our weeds and our really nice crop that we had too. And so it was there five different components to regenerative agriculture. We've got all. We grow endomycorrhizal fungi. I'll say that again too. But we grow that in a beam reactor. And when we've done a field or part of a field with, and then a part of the field without, the part of the field with these fungi added to the planting, phenomenal difference in the end product. And that's kind of where we are, except for going on with, and I know she wants to say a lot more.
Do you now have the goats, or they come temporarily?
They come temporarily.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big business now for fire suppression in Northern California to have the goats come through and clean up all the underbrush and they'll go up certain trees quite a ways and get rid of what is a tremendous amount of fire danger.
Wow. So, I was going to say that when I first talked how we all started, you know, it was on small gardens, community gardens, a person who had maybe a quarter of an acre we worked on.
Yeah.
And then in 2017, I think that to answer that question of how we got to where we are now, one of my textile friends had an acreage, several acres, and behind her house, and it was an old almond orchard that needed to come out. So she approached us and said, hey, you guys, you know, I'll give you a really sweet deal on renting. And it's got a beautiful barn in the middle. It was like, yes. You know, the barn, it was a great space, 3.75 acres we've been working on. And
oh, that's not as much as I thought.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can produce a heck of a lot. I mean, we yes. are still doing little bits of it with our flax because we're rotating with the cover crops, and we've had to heal a lot of the soil because traditional way of doing the almonds is to put pre-emergence around the base of the trees and then grow some kind of, let the weeds and you just mow it between the trees and the orchards. So this is how it was done. And 18 years or so, it accumulated. And when we first got this little area, it was a little bit later than when we wanted it, but it was in February. So we did like a 50 by 50 plot to see. And boy, you could see the pre-emergent was still in the ground because where the trees were, it was stunted little flax. And then where the rows of between the trees, it's nice and tall. So we did research. We found, you know, called the county, and I said, you know, I don't even remember the chemicals, something very strong that they used. And he said, oh, that should dissipate in 24 months. She hadn't used that for over a year because her trees weren't producing. And here, you know, we were well beyond the 24 months. And, you know, that was in 2017. We have seen the streaking. It's going away. I think we were doing tilling, and that seemed to kind of eliminate some, it seemed to kind of evaporate. And so those areas weren't as strong. I think the Michael Reisel has helped, you know, having the cover crop rotation, they're getting stronger. So because of that problem we have, we've only done like an acre here, an acre there. So we're starting to get to that expanse now where we've been actually seeing tremendous change by not having the striping. And
2 years ago, we were about to harvest, I think it was 0.05 of an acre, less than 2 full acres. Really nice, good quality flax ready to go. The Wednesday, we had a group of volunteers coming up from the Bay Area. 54 people had signed up to come and help us harvest. The Wednesday before our harvest, the state of California shut down thanks to COVID. So no one was willing to experiment with going out and visiting with other people and took it seriously that this was going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. Well, it was. And by the time we were able to get a few people out and practice social distancing, we didn't wear masks out in the field, but we did when we were in the barn or associated. We harvested about 15% of that 2 acres and got some really nice quality. I think we were expecting somewhere over 20,000 pounds. And no, that doesn't sound right. But anyhow, we were expecting a large amount. We ended up with about 2,000 pounds.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Dry straw, you know, multiply that by 85 hundredths, and you would then end up with what we were expecting or could have gotten. The weeds took over. We didn't have people to help. As a consequence, we tilled under all of that stuff. We mowed it, and then tilled it. So that was disappointing. This year, we cut back and planted just over 1.25 acres. And kind of the same thing. We could not get volunteers, so we hired a farm labor contractor. And before we could get him out, time passed, and we still didn't harvest as much as we wanted. And in some respects, it's good because right now we're having a hard time finding people to help process.
That was going to be my next question. Okay. What do you do with it? Yeah.
Okay. We got a machine 2 years ago.
Right.
That's
when we started really doing.
We collaborated with the engineering department at Cal State University, Chico. And they were the team that was working on our project had removed from the school virtually all of the parts and pieces and plans that they needed and were working on it at home before the COVID hit.
And that's to make a mechanical break.
And that was to do a mechanical break, which rapidly, really increased. We estimate that the machine can do in 90 seconds what a person can do on the old mechanical break in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So it increased our productivity and ensured greater quality at the end.
Yeah. And one of the things that first year we got the farm and we had this smaller volume than what we had, we decided, well, if we're going to keep doing this, we have to make a product. And so even as laborious as the flax processing is, we actually got plans. We made a traditional break, a scutching paddle, and then the hackles with the nails. And we hired three other people, myself. So we had a crew of four, and we got up really early in the morning and we worked till like 11 o'clock, you know, from 6 to 11 before the heat got bad. And we produced about 750 pounds. We were so proud of that within a month, because I had to watch my budget. You know, we were hiring people. And I thought, wow, you know, four people who could work together as a team, we'd rotate the jobs, we could make it happen. And then that's the following year. That's when the college student, we've mentioned earlier, we have a really close connection with the agriculture department and other departments because they're so excited about what we're doing. And I think, well, Daryl's teaching background and I've taught a little bit, so that we kind of magnets to that, I think. And it's actually been very helpful that the engineering department had heard about us. And it was one of the professors that had done one of the senior mechanical engineering classes, put it together. They made a mini break. And we didn't know this was going on, which is quite exciting. And that's when we heard about the capstone project through this one class. And that's how we got those students to come in. So this is our second year using the mechanical break. I mean, it still needs more work, but I can get quite a bit done.
Yeah.
And it's probably the smallest crew I've had, but I have one woman and she and I go out there, you know, and we're getting it done.
And what's the product that comes out of the break? Is it?
The break is the first one. It's
the product is toe. The short fiber.
Straw comes out of the break first. Then the toe
is the product.
Then you send the toe to get a spun.
Yes. And that I blend right now, because there are no linen mills in America, so I can't do pure linen. So as it gets down the line, the toe goes to, I've been marketing some wool and flax blend. And then I've been working with the cotton now, which I really want to focus a lot more with Sally Fox's brown cotton, so kind of keep it local. And we've been blending it and I want to do more with that. So yeah, the toe is used for that, but I am acquiring quite a bit of the long line. So that someday. Yeah.
Well, we've had a teaser from some friends in France who have a friend who has a small linen spinning mill. And so we asked them to ask him if he would be interested in doing a sample for us and what would the sample size need to be. Well, he responded that about 100 pounds of long line flax linen. It's not linen till it's spun in the United States. Right. And so we're looking for that. When we get to 100 pounds, I think we'll send him the 100 pounds of long line linen and we will then have 100% linen yarns. And hopefully, well, they can produce some really nice stuff in different sizes. In sequence, we have a wool linen blend. It's completely local. The sheep that volunteered their wool to us had survived the campfire. It burned all around their pasture. And they lost one wooden fence post, but they were in the part that was being irrigated as the fire burned through. So they survived. They got trimmed up that following spring and gave us their wool. We then made a wool linen blended yarn, and Sandy has dyed some, and our website has some pictures of the different colors. And then last year we had some really nice toe. I mean, it was absolute drop dead gorgeous. And we sent it to the University of North Carolina, and they did some experiments and came up with a cotton linen blend for us. And this is where the Sally Fox colored cotton comes in. She gave us, no, she didn't give us, but we bought from her brown cotton and mixed it with our linen yarn. So it's a 100% natural color. There's no dyes or anything added to it. And again, I'll use this drop dead gorgeous. Sandy just put some things on our website,
Instagram.
It is really nice. And it's gotten some really good reviews from professional weavers,
knitters.
Yeah. Right now, it's looking pretty darn good. It's clean. It's, as far as toe goes, it's a longer fibers than some of the really short stuff.
How do I know my flax is ready?
Yeah.
It actually starts getting a little yellow at the bottom and greener on the top. That's kind of your clue. And you might start losing a little leaves at the bottom. So then you're kind of pulling it when it's still got a little green on it. You know, it's not all golden. Then you let that dry, just, you know, so that you get some of that green, you know, just naturally the green dies out. So you want it pretty yellow by the time. And I go through something called redding. Now, in probably where you guys are in the East Coast, I know a lot of people that are growing it can do ret because they get the dew from the humidity. And that gives you, and in France, it's like that too. And that gives you that gorgeous gray color. It's a fungi that comes on the outside that causes that. And then there's the water redding, which is the golden. So let Daryl talk about our dew redding in a little bit because we don't have dew. So we've had to modify the water redding. And, you know, you're going, oh my, I mean, my mind's going, I'm in a drought. What am I going to do? You know, because that's, I don't want to use a lot of water. So we have tanks that hold about 35 pounds of our dried flax and about 100 gallons of water. And it replicates a pond. And so I'm not draining it a lot. And it's kind of, it creates kind of like a sourdough starter. It's a very stinky smell, you know, and it's very organic. And that's bacteria that's eating at that. And, you know, flax fiber is a bast fiber. And that means that the fiber itself is on the exterior of the plant. So the redding process has to break down that core, and it's very woody. So then your fiber can come off of it. So the water redding or the dew redding is a process that does that. So when I put it in the water, I just drain a little bit and that goes out into my field. So I'm actually enhancing my composting by doing that. So I don't feel I'm wasting the water totally. And then I can drain a little bit out of it. So when the fiber is ready, after about 3 to 5 days, I'm going to have to test it. So I'll take out a bundle and I let it dry. It has to be dry. And then I take from that, it can snap it like I hear a snap sound. I break it, you know, with my hands, or I'll take a strand and wrap it around my finger. And then that'll start separating that fiber. I'll start seeing the fiber. So when that's all done, then I start the actual mechanical processing of it. Okay. When I can get the redding done, that can stay in my barn for a good few years. It's not necessarily good to let it sit for, I read someplace they found some that was over 50 years old in Europe and they were able to process it. It may not have been as great quality, but that readiness, it's key that you can get that done during, and for us, it's great because the summertime is warm, it dries quickly. Yeah. And then I can let it go for months before I can process it.
Because we don't get dew, and dew is nothing more than the moisture in the air condensing as the temperature drops at night. Well, we have a very dry climate. So even though the temperature drops really low, low being into the 60s, we don't get much in the way of dew. I think you can probably count them on 10 days a year. We experimented quite a few years ago with an artificial dew redding, and I found a nozzle that puts out a very miserly amount of water, very small water particles, and they're in the air for quite a while. And we just, around this standpipe, we put the straw and then turned it every couple of days. In 10 days, running about 5 gallons a night, which is not a lot of water, and we had a 40-foot diameter circle. So that's a lot of flax. And in 10 days, it was ready. And this was our artificial dew redding. And I would turn people on to the Big Book of Flax by the Zinzendorf brothers. Where are they? They're in Pennsylvania, isn't it? They're in Pennsylvania. They go into it in great detail. And they're both really nice people and more than willing to help.
Okay. So after the redding's done and everything's dry again, because you can't do it wet, then the break, and it's this freestanding, I'm going to try to describe this, and it has like almost an arm that comes down and it crashes down onto the flax, and
like a press. I'm picturing like a printing press or a book press.
Well
no, it's more of like a little arm. yeah,
regression kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I've seen this on YouTube.
YouTube, you can go. There's great YouTubes.
Yeah, on that. There's a lot of those.
And so what the class, the students developed were like cylinders, round cylinders that I have on one side, I feed it in and it crushes it. And then I have someone on the other side to retrieve it. And so then we can take it through as many times as we need to, and it will get all of that core broken. And then you get tons of debris, you know, straw and scrape.
And then you have to sort it, the broken core from the fiber?
No, you don't. Well, that comes later with that combing.
It'll, okay.
But at this point, it's really critical. If it's been redded properly, it will come out really clean. A lot of that shaft, it's called shaft, will drop to the ground. And then we then take it to the combs. We find that this system works so well. There's something else called a scutching paddle, and that beats it some more that the break may not get. And we don't really do that because I found that I got to the pieces I could ret really well, I could just go right to the combs.
Yeah.
Cool.
So then it goes through, the combs are like, over 1,000, they're beds of nails really that are, and they're spaced. The first one is they're spaced further apart. And so you kind of put it on top of the combs and let it kind of fall into the combs. And you literally are, I kind of like it's meditative. I mean, you know, even if I got more automated on the first few parts, which are really critical, I don't mind standing there combing. And that takes off some of the straw and the shorter lengths is what it's doing. It's sorting and it's letting the toe come away. And those are shorter pieces that have caused during the breaking. Yeah. And it's fun because I've watched people as I train them and you start out with this big handful and you come up with this itty bitty one, you know, as you learn, finally you learn where to draw the line on your combing and you can actually get a pretty good bundle to out of it. But your tendency is to overcomb. So you'll do this first one. And then the second group goes as fun, the nails are closer together. And then the third one. And then I just take that little short, what's left in the combs, I take that and I put it in the bucket and that's going to go towards my blends, my yarn blends.
So the toe is pieces that are too small to actually use.
They're short. Well, they can be used. I mean, you can spin them, but what you're looking for ideally for pure linen is you want those really long strands. So that's what your goal is, to end up with all these processing steps, the longer pieces that, you know, that, I mean, when we're I'm showing you how long that is, but I use a number. I mean, you're going to get over, 3 feet length. That's good.
Oh,
yeah.
And the long piece, that's the line?
Line. That's what you, and the other thing I didn't mention that's really critical is when we harvest it, we have to pull it, right? We have to have the roots. So maybe you've heard you pull the flax because you want the roots. And then you want the top part. And during the whole process, I'm very conscious of keeping that root end together and then the seed end.
Yeah.
And you can actually feel the difference when you're combing. There is a subtle, it's a coarser feel to one end and it's softer where the seed heads are. And I'm not a spinner, but I've talked to some of my local spinners that they find that the reason you want it the coarse, so you're spinning it, so you have the coarse end, and then the finer end can joins, it blends it, because there's no, it's not like wool has barbs on it, right? I mean, the different fleece. And so there's nothing like that. And so that kind of made sense to me when you get it, they have to get it wet, and then the root end can join to the head end, and then you can continue.
At the microscopic level, the fibers start in the roots, that's why they have to be pulled.
Yeah.
And they taper slightly towards the end. And the closest thing others people can imagine or have some familiarity with would be some bamboo, because not only do they taper from the bottom to the top, but linen fibers have these little microscopic nodules along that fiber. And when twisted together, those add that incredible strength that you get when you pull them nodule to nodule, so to speak, and make your fibers. And that's why the long lines allow you to make really fine, fine threads or yarns. And then the toe will do the in-betweens, especially for other things where you don't need to make them quite so small. That's about as technical as I want to get.
That's fascinating. I want to interject here a quick story. Good Dirt listeners might have heard this story already, but I guess 4 years ago when my mom and I first started Lady Farmer.
It's been 5 years.
Oh gosh, 5 years ago when we started Lady Farmer, our mission was, we started out, we wanted to produce a line of sustainably produced clothing. and neither of us have any experience in the fashion industry. So, which was probably,
which
I think,
why we started a business.
Yeah, exactly. At the end of the day, I think was actually really helpful because we just went in asking all the, you know, the dumb questions, so to speak. So we went to this someone who we know, a family friend who has been in the fashion industry forever, said, oh, you need to go, you're starting a clothing line. You need to just go to Magic in Las Vegas, the big trade show, just to see what it is. And you can see the sourcing area and everything and pick out your fabrics and stuff. I don't think he really understood what we were doing. And so we went there and we're like, oh, this is great. We're going to design clothes. And then we walk up to the like sourcing booth and we're like, can you point us in the direction of domestically grown organic linen, please?
Yeah.
And there, everyone was like, and we were like, what?
Yeah.
We were like, you don't have made in America organic linen? No. And now here we are. It feels very full circle for me, Mom. I feel like we're talking to the king and queen of domestic regenerative linen. It's an honor. We found them.
I know. That was like just the beginning of our path, you know?
Yeah.
Our first thing. It was literally like a month after we came up with the idea to even do
linen. Yeah, we were like, why can't we find linen clothes born in
that
USA?
Place, even any
exactly.
That place was the size of like, I don't know, 5-10 football fields. I don't
know. Oh, yeah. We've been there.
I've done some conventions.
We said, is there anything made in America domestic? And there was this like little corner. There was like literally a little corner. With a couple of little booths with pamphlets about. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that was the biggest eye opener. That was like,
I know it.
But thank you for that explanation of step by step of the processing because you know you think, and you said it so well how you know people they get the idea of how much work it takes because you sort of fantasize about we could grow a little snacks and then have a party for people to come.
Yeah. well, we thought that. It's so funny. When I think back when we first did this, it was like, the volunteers, we could have fun. We'll get music.
Yeah.
There's that side that I, you know, now that we've hired this crew, it was amazing how productive they were. And what was so fun for them is that they had never picked flax before. It was all almonds, olives, walnuts, and they loved the change of it, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, over just my own experience, I found ways. Well, okay, I'm not a machine, but how can I replicate how the machine harvests? And one of the things that my dream machine is to get a harvester, you know.
Yes.
But till that day, and so we would pull, and then we'd lay it down, and so we create those rows, right? Mm-hmm. That works until you have what happened to us this year because. We did harvest early because the crop was ready, which was in March. But we also, because we had such a dry February, the weeds just kind of got
crazy.
Ahead of us.
They went crazy.
So we couldn't do that nice straight line. So we had, I said, don't bother with the crew. We're just going to pull around them, you know, and I'll come find them later and bundle them up, you know. So that was quite an eye-opener too this year. But it was so nice to have people that would, you know, that's what they were doing. And I think it deserves to be paid.
Can I share the Belgian flax harvesting machine story?
I was going to ask Al to tell a story.
tell a story. He's good at stories. Here we go.
Well, anyhow, we kept seeing these things on
YouTube or
European YouTubes and what's that other one, Vimeo or something. Yeah. There's a couple of others where we could get these videos. And I'm going, wow, what's the name on that flax harvester? Oh, I wrote it down. And we started contacting these people and they never responded. Yeah. And I thought, oh my gosh, they must think we're really small time. But we have a whole acre now. And so anyhow, we finally got through to them through our friends in France because they could communicate in French and our friends are in the textile business also. So anyhow, they could use the same vocabulary and be understood. Well, it turns out they quit making the small ones around World War II. And this was the ones that'll harvest 3 feet wide or 6 feet wide. They now only harvest 24 feet wide. So anyhow, and they only sell to people who are growing 5,000 acres at a time.
Yeah.
Oh, 5,000.
That's a little beyond our farm.
And also, I thought it was interesting. He kind of expressed that he wasn't dealing with individual farmers. He was dealing with countries.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah.
His client is Belgium.
Yeah, right.
So anyhow, but he was friendly to us after he responded to us and invited us when we come to Europe to go and see their shop, which I would do because their machinery was really famous from the 20s up until World War II.
Yeah.
So
that's fascinating that it's literally not made anymore.
Yeah. And because we kept asking about, you know, hey, I would like to have your 6-foot roller, you know, no, they don't even make it anymore.
It can't have been that long since people were doing this by hand, you know.
In Oregon, they had the industry going up till about the 60s.
Yeah.
And they had a smaller scale harvester that's now, I think, in a museum. And what happened, if you think about the 60s, for mass production, linen just got pushed aside because, well, it wrinkled. Who wants that? And then there's these polyesters and the lycra. And so the fashion world, one of our acquaintances on the East Coast was a retired teacher from the Fashion Institute of New York. And he had this pie chart. And it's only like, you know, the fashion is like, there's still a lot of these synthetics, you know, and then you've got wool and you got cotton, and then linen is just a tad on there, 1 or 4%.
1%.
Okay, girls.
1%.
Okay.
1% of the total fashion market uses linen.
Right now?
Yes. Yeah. And it's been that way, but it's always had such a elegant aspect to it. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to, you know, I think the royalty, they would wear those long line clothes. Yeah. They would never wear, I mean, toe was made into clothes for the peasants, but they would never wear that. Yeah. So, I mean, it still has that classy, I mean, silk has that too, you know, but, and I always think of silk and linen kind of as buddies, you know, the same on the same scale of class. And I think that I'm all for the small scale flax industry. I mean, I think even in America, I think that that's kind of the way that we can make it happen. I mean, there's several that are sincere and wanting to try it and keeping it small, get those little harvesters made again, getting our equipment small. Because, you know, even though we're not doing our 3.75 acres, when we do, we can produce a heck of a lot to make some money off of it.
Somebody needs to make a small harvester.
I think so.
Get out there.
Or locate one. I mean, I'm sure you've looked. Are there any like antique ones that are?
No. Okay. What's going on worldwide, there's a resurgence of interest in flax.
Okay.
So used equipment up until about 10 years ago was available. Mm. You could find used equipment. Today, no, there aren't any.
In fact, that's what that man said to us.
This is what came out. Historically, the historical sequence of this is that DuPont came out with monofilament nylon in the late 20s, I think it was, just before the Depression. During World War II, at the beginning of the war, most of the parachute cords were linen. By the end of the war, they were all nylon. And parachute cords became the standard for bootlaces, for on and on and on. And so that was one of the killers. Even though in some places, linen was always a small scale industry, with co-ops or industries within a country or a province would get together and then do something with them. Mm-hmm. So it's different. And yes, in Oregon, one of the things that was mentioned in an article for killing the industry, besides some other stuff, but the biggest one was the closing down of using prison labor to do the harvesting and the processing.
That is really interesting. You know, it reminds me of the hemp story as well, because hemp was a homestead kind of crop. Small scale, people did it by hand.
And I've heard something similar to not the parachute cords and the shoelaces, but hemp was the main for its sails for the boats.
There was a company in Baltimore that made
used in the military, and then the nylon sort of just replaced it.
That's interesting, because you know, you sort of see a trend that these small natural operations were pushed out by the big synthetics, and here you go. And you know, reversing that, turning back on that is proving to be quite the task.
What was the original seed, though, for you guys that planted the
Maryland?
The variety?
I mean the proverbial seed, the idea.
That too. I wanted to know that too. My question was leading into, we'll get back to that. But my question to Daryl, I wanted to, what have you guys seen in terms of like growth of the movement or, you know, consciousness or awareness? Have you seen it like just really blossom where you are? People understanding what this is about?
Yeah. In the last couple of years, maybe just because we've been out there, we've had a lot of people contacting us about doing small scale, maybe their barnyard or they've got a small parcel and want to try it. And one of our friends in Yuba City, Marysville area, which is only about 50, 60 miles away, he got the idea. He was a x-ray technician. He was an RN.
He's still part-time.
Yeah. Anyhow, he just thought, oh, I can make a shirt.
Yeah.
So he's bought some seeds and he's been growing it for several years and spinning it himself.
And learning to weave.
And sometime soon he'll get there.
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more people with that sort of obsessive compulsive component. And I think in some ways that's what it is, because the other component we're seeing is we got a call from a grower who had put in quite a few acres and had harvested his stuff for seed and sold the seed. And he said it was an oil seed, which is essentially the same thing as a food flax. Anyhow, and he said he's got these big round bales that he's got a tremendous number. And I think he was thinking I would buy them and we could process it into linen fibers. And when I got through telling him that no, that you if you grew it to harvest seed, you grew it way past its usefulness as a fiber. It's no use. I said, if you've got a lot of it, you could probably sell it to this mill in northern Poland, and they do nothing but make baler twine and light ropes. And their thing is to use those kind of fibers, but he didn't want, I think he was really wanting to sell it. That's the other component that we're seeing, is people want to make some money real quick. They'll grow it. Well, you know, we're not buying it, but we'll let you come and process it, or come and we'll work with you and train you on how to process it. So you can either get disillusioned or you can go on with it. You know,
There isn't.
And the worst part from our perspective is if somebody said, oh, I've already Redded it, and you go, oh my God, no. and the chances are that it wouldn't be useful anyhow.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what Emma was asking was, Daryl, if you were already growing linen before
Flax.
Before Sandy.
Sorry, I understand.
Had her moments and got her group together, which is a great story. What was inspiring you way back when?
We kind of hit that together. I didn't want to get too involved at the very, very beginning for a wide variety of reasons. I waited until all these numbers of people were self-selecting that they would continue or not continue. And then I got involved in the mechanical technical stuff. And that's kind of my forte. And Sandy, of course, is the fabrics and the those things and the artistic side, because she's really a great artist.
So speaking of that part of it, so currently in your operation, what is your output? Are you mostly R&D? Are you producing this tow, it sounds like, mostly, and then selling that? How is this working for you guys now?
Well, I have to say, just because we couldn't get a whole acre done, you know, it's more of an R&D, but it's enough for me to actually make a product, you know, because I can sell enough on a limited scale. I'm finding, I've had fun with weaving it, you know, and I'm finding that a lot of my clientele are people who want that finished product. and
the finished product being like a woven piece of fabric.
A woven piece, yeah. And I've been doing shawls and actually created my Chico, back to, remember I talked earlier about Chico cloth? Well, I did the fabric that way. So I still want to see that happen. And I'm kind of drawn to having more of the finished product right now because of the, it's a doable volume that I could do, but I also want to try like, last year I had enough, I put them into, for the wool and flax blend, I put them into 50 gram balls and I was going to go to some yarn shops. Well, everything was kind of closed down. So this year I see myself in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a couple of them that sell locally sourced wool. And I'd like to try that to see, because I feel like if I have the product out there, my demands are there, then why not expand my production end of it and work out that. I mean, it kind of all works together.
One of the things that we recognized several years ago was we have to have a product. Mm-hmm. Okay. If we can't sell something, we can't pay for what we've been doing. In the big picture, it's research.
Yeah.
But we've developed some things that are saleable.
Yeah.
And for the most part, despite the economic situation in the United States, thanks to COVID and the burning fires that are going on and this sort of thing, you know, we've been getting well received. We are in a process now where we need to extend that area of being well received and encourage some purchases to take place so that we can continue what we're doing and then expand even more.
Then you have a table at Magic.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about the dye hedgerow. Is that what y'all call it?
Okay. Yes.
Oh, this is good. How that came about was we were awarded a California
Department of Food and Agriculture.
Department of Food and Agriculture grant to put in a hedgerow. It was all for carbon sequestering. And so I thought, you know, let's go California natives. I want to select ones that bloom all year round. And a lot of those are my dye plant. We have elderberry, coyote bush, toyon, a couple of them I'm going to experiment with we have a buckwheat, but I don't know if it'll die, but we're going to do some more experimenting. Yeah. But after 4 years of that, they started producing last year for the first time, especially the elderberry.
17 varieties of California natives.
Yeah.
14 of them are dye plants.
Yeah.
There isn't a time period throughout the year that we don't have something blossoming.
Yeah, that was my goal.
Oh, that's lovely.
And it's really neat to see. I highly encourage hedgerows because I've seen habitat and pollinators and birds coming back that weren't there because the orchard didn't sustain them. And it's really wonderful to see that. So there's the plus on that. So that's been, when I started getting the elderberries out of it and I started dyeing it, and our barn actually has a space that I'm making it into a dye area where we can offer workshops where there's a whole group of people that are creating like a little, I'm going to call it a club, an organization of natural dyers. And so, I've said, hey, let's get this here. You can come and dye because it's hard to get a facility in your kitchen or your backyard to do that. So that's one of our future goals. Yeah. And through a seed fund grant from Fibershed, we actually are acquiring some other plants as borders that we're planting. We had some calendulas, coreopsis. We were shorthanded, so this next year I'm going to be putting more in the fall for growth. Couldn't quite get there this year that I was hoping. So that's the next phase for us.
Wonderful. So is elderberry one that will stay? It's not a fugitive?
It does fade a little bit. But, I always put that as a little, to me, a lot of the plants, I want to have them, of course, last longer than others. But I think that's the wonder of it, if it does fade. Yeah.
True. We're so used to things needing to be permanent, like plastic. And, we can think about it a different way. Like it is a plant. It is a living, vibrant thing I'm going to try some of my elderberry.
Yeah. In our climate, elderberry is a year round. We get color
only once a year.
We planted elderberry, most of them were 8 inches high.
Yeah.
And many of them are now over 12 foot.
Yeah.
So they get enormous.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they kind of like, I've heard they like edges of things.
It's a great for hedgerow. Yeah. I highly recommend that. They're great.
So what does the good dirt mean to you, literally or metaphorically?
You know, I think Good Dirt is helping the world with all the climate change. And it's so in my face right now. I mean, I go outside and I can't, you know, breathe very well. So I feel like putting my hands in that soil that's going to create that fiber that I'm going to be putting on my loom to then having harvesting that elderberry. I mean, that's the Good Dirt to me. Yeah. It comes from within, yet it's also around me. So
for me, when we first took over this property, after the orchard was removed and the stumps pulled out or ground, no, they didn't grind them, they dug them out. And it was a really fine soil. It's river bottom soil in the Great Valley of California. Beautiful stuff, grows anything, but it had been mistreated with chemicals and mechanical things for quite a few years. Anyhow, what I'm seeing, what makes me feel good, like we do have good dirt, is that now I can go out there and in our cover crop and I can pull up a weed and pull it out by the roots and there's an earthworm. We did not have earthworms anywhere on the property when we bought it. We never found an earthworm. We found lots of ants and we still have ants. We still have those little fire ants things. But so now I can pull up a weed and almost every one of them will have an earthworm. So I pull a little earthworm out, put it back in where it was, and then back the soil down.
Is good dirt.
It means to me that now what I grow here is going to be healthy. If I'm going to eat it, it's going to be good for me, whatever it might be, because we do grow a few other things out there once in a while. And that we're contributing to the reversal of the, what I want to say, monoculture, high use of petroleum products for fertilizer, for weed control, for
the finished product. And you should have that.
I'm looking forward to getting a shirt too.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want the listeners, the world, your people to understand about the work that you're doing?
I think that there's a lot of the creator in it. And that should be appreciated. And I've always had that. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've always worked with my hands. And way back when I was in college, I went to Africa. And I wasn't a textile person then, but I lived with a tribe of people. And the bead work they did was all handwork. And then we went to a little island off the coast of Kenya called Lamu, and they had boat builders, and they were all built by their hands. And so I think that there's an awareness that all these hands are making things that I wear, you know, and it becomes so special that I'm not just buying a garment because I like it, but I know that someone who made it, you know, put their hands in it, and maybe if it's a sheep that I like or an animal or a plant, that I have that connection to that, and that I can purchase that outfit and feel good about it. And I think that's the awareness I'd like to bring to people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would like to be able to say to all of your listeners that if you are interested in trying this, rather than reinvent the wheel, you could communicate with us and we can either point you at something or share tips on how to come up with the combs quickly, easily, accurately, meaningfully. I have a tool that really works. And other parts of the redding, the tank redding, the artificial dew redding, and stuff like that, because there's a lot of stuff that I'm seeing a lot of people are going through. I'd like to help you not have to go through it again.
That is so generous.
It is. I mean, resource sharing, experience sharing, all that.
That's not very capitalist of you, Durag.
Consultation fee. No, thank you. That's great. And that's what this community is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Going for a new way. And
Yes.
Thank you so much. Well, y'all, this was so interesting. I loved it. Emma and I have come a long way since the magic thing in 2016.
Yeah, now we get it. And we have found true resonance with this. Our job now is to help other people understand why there's no domestically grown organic linen.
What you're doing. Yeah. I follow you guys on Instagram, and that's where I heard about you.
Yeah.
Yay.
I go, I know who they are.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, please don't forget to go to www.ladyfarmer.com/survey, where you will tell us about all of your hopes and dreams for the Good Dirt Podcast, and you will get your 15% off the Almanac membership and be entered to win a free slow living retreat ticket.
And thank you again, Sandy and Durrell, for coming on and telling us all about your exciting flax project and helping us to bring domestically produced linen back home to the U.S. of A. We are excited about this.
Yes, this one's very exciting.
All right, folks, we'll see you next week. Bye.
See you next week.